Turn with me to the 35th Psalm. Contend, O Lord, with those who contend with me. Fight against those who fight against me. Take hold of shield and buckler and rise for my help. Draw the spear and javelin against my pursuers. Say to my soul, I am your salvation. Let them be put to shame and dishonor who seek after my life. Let them be turned back and disappointed who devise evil against me. Let them be like chaff before the wind, with the angel of the Lord driving them away. Let their way be dark and slippery, with the angel of the Lord pursuing them. For without cause they hid their net for me. Without cause they dug a pit for my life. Let destruction come upon him when he does not know it, and let the net that he hid ensnare him. Let him fall into it, to his destruction. Then my soul will rejoice in the Lord, exulting in his salvation. All my bones shall say, O Lord, who is like you, delivering the poor from him who is too strong for him, the poor and needy from him who robs him. Malicious witnesses rise up. They ask me of things that I do not know. They repay me evil for good. My soul is bereft. But I, when they were sick, I wore sackcloth. I afflicted myself with fasting. I prayed with head bowed on my chest. I went about as though I grieved for my friend or my brother. As one who laments his mother, I bowed down in the morning. But at my stumbling, they rejoiced and gathered. They gathered together against me. Wretches whom I did not know tore at me without ceasing. Like profane mockers at a feast, they gnash at me with their teeth. How long, O Lord, will you look on? Rescue me from their destruction, my precious life from the lions. I will thank you in the great congregation, and in the mighty throng I will praise you. Let not those rejoice over me who are wrongfully my foes, and let not those wink the eye who hate me without cause. For they do not speak peace, but against those who are quiet in the land, they devise words of deceit. They open wide their mouths against me. They say, aha, aha, our eyes have seen it. You have seen, O Lord, be not silent. O Lord, be not far from me. Awake and rouse yourself from my vindication, for my cause, my God and my Lord. Vindicate me, O Lord my God, according to your righteousness, and let them not rejoice over me. Let them not say in their hearts, aha, our heart's desire. Let them not say, we have swallowed him up. Let them be put to shame and disappointed altogether who rejoice at my calamity. Let them be clothed with shame and dishonor who magnify themselves against me. Let those who delight in my righteousness shout for joy and be glad and say evermore, great is the Lord who delights in the welfare of his servant. Then my tongue shall tell of your righteousness and of your praise all the day long. The word of the Lord. Please pray with me. Father, lead us in the path of your commands, for there we find delight. Incline our hearts to your testimonies, and not to selfish gain. Turn our eyes away from worthless things, and renew our lives according to your word. For we ask it in the name of your word made flesh, Jesus. Amen. It should be painfully obvious that this psalm is a psalm of lament. I don't think there's any escaping that conclusion. What's interesting about it is that it doesn't follow a typical song of lament, at least what we would expect to find. There are certain identifiable elements, and while they are present, they're not present in the distinct fashion that a more conventional song of lament would show. The plea for deliverance, that part of a lament, and the lament itself are woven together throughout this psalm. The opening, the address to God, launches almost immediately into the plea for deliverance. And as we look at the structure of the psalm, we'll see even more vividly how the mindset that David brings to this moment is one almost bordering on panic. It's certainly urgent. This in contrast to what we saw in Psalm 34. And that leads to the second part of our first set of questions. What is the type? What's the setting? While it is somewhat conjectural, there is good reason to believe that Psalms 34 and 35 are companions, that they are flip sides of the same coin. Whereas in Psalm 34, David, in being driven into the wilderness by Saul and his henchmen, Saul, who out of envy was pursuing David's life, David runs away and finds his way eventually to the city of Gath, Philistine city, the king of which was Achish. It happened to be the town where Goliath had been raised, Goliath whom David killed. What was he thinking? I want to meet David and say, were you dumb or just stupid on this one? I mean, you go to the city of the people of the guy you killed in battle, and you think they're not going to recognize you. Anyway, he goes there, quickly sees his mistake, feigns madness, and runs away from that place too. Ends up in the wilderness where we find him reflecting on Israel's experience, them having been driven away from Egypt, fleeing the Egyptian army who was in hot pursuit of them. And then as they go into the wilderness years, all the nations around them forbid them from staying anywhere near them. They had to wander. And David begins to see in the experience of his countrymen and his forefathers, his own experience. In Psalm 34, the tone is very different. It is confident, almost triumphant. He is exulting in the truth that God will deliver him, and he knows it. Psalm 35, though, if it is in fact the companion piece to Psalm 34, is exactly the opposite. It is near despair. It is him reflecting on his circumstances, seeing that he's being pursued by people who want to take his life, and he doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know how to feel. God appears not to have followed him, and he's pleading with God to deliver him. That leads us to consideration of the psalm itself. So let's look at Psalm 35 and its structure. Verses 1 through 6 are the address / plea for deliverance. Verses 1 through 3 are what one would expect from the plea. It's David saying, fight for me. You have to be my champion. I was Israel's champion. I went to bat for Israel. I fought Goliath. I need you to be my champion now. One would expect that it would stop there, but it goes on in verses 4 through 6. Let them be put to shame and dishonor who seek my life. Let them be turned back and disappointed. He goes from crying out for deliverance to wanting vengeance. He goes from wanting God to act to wanting God to act in a specific way to see his enemies brought down. This introduces an element that we will encounter again in the Psalter. These cries for vengeance. And as followers of Christ, it has troubled his people for years how to respond to these Psalms that want blood, that want their enemies taken down, whether it's David or one of the other psalmists. And we've had to wrestle with the question, how do we respond to this? When we hear Jesus saying, turn the other cheek, bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse, forgive them. How many times? 70 or 7 times? No, as many as 70 times 7. Come on, Peter. To which Peter says, give me faith. Yeah. This is not instinctive, is it, to want to be merciful, especially toward those who have done us wrong. We'll come back to this issue in a minute, but we want to see that this is an issue. This apparent, it can be viewed as a contradiction if we don't look at it more carefully. But there it is, this desire for vengeance. Verse 7 leads, I need to point out in verses 5 and 6 why scholars will look at Psalm 35 and say it is quite possibly a companion of 34. In 34, David speaks of the angel of the Lord encamping around Israel. And here again in Psalm 35, he mentions the angel of the Lord in verses 5 and 6. We've seen already from Exodus 14 that the angel of the Lord is identified with the pillar of cloud. And in Exodus 14, the angel of the Lord, identified as the pillar of cloud, goes around behind Israel as they come up out of the Red Sea to protect them as Egypt's armies enter the Red Sea to pursue them. So it's very interesting then in verses 5 and 6, let them be like chaff before the wind with the angel of the Lord driving them away. Let their way be dark and slippery with the angel of the Lord pursuing them. Derek Kidner in his commentary notes that is a very moist image. You can almost feel the water dripping off of it. Yeah, that's a lot of water that drowned Egypt. And David has this deliverance in mind. The use of the phrase, the angel of the Lord, in 34 and 35 is interesting because it's the only two places in the entire Psalter where that specific phrase is used, the angel of the Lord. There again, giving some notion to the idea that this is David, on the one hand exalted, on the other hand in near despair. Verse 7 introduces the first hint of the notion of the complaint, what it actually is. For without cause they hid their net for me. Without cause, they dug a pit for my life. And immediately, he's back at it. Verse 8, let destruction come upon him when he does not know it. Let the net that he hid ensnare him. Verses 9 and 10 indicate a section of praise which would be present in a psalm of lament. But there's another aspect of this psalm that's troubling. Not only do we have to contend with the presence of a desire for vengeance, now David seems to be making his praise contingent on a bargain he would strike with God. Have you ever bargained with God? Have you ever said, if you give me this, then I'll give you that? Well, it almost sounds like David's doing that. If you'll deliver me, then I'll praise you. Then I'll thank you. When I see destruction come upon them, I'll praise you. It is true that in verse 10, he uses the same word again that he used in Psalm 34, the word poor, delivering the poor from him who is too strong for him. Remember that in Psalm 34, that word is used and translated as humble. In both instances, both in Psalm 34 and here, it could be translated, and I really don't know why it isn't. It could be translated afflicted or distressed. It's not the inward condition of the person being humble. It's the outward circumstances that are afflicting and distressing that would cause one to feel humbled in those circumstances. David is feeling all of that. Remember that David was the youngest of his brothers, and he was out there in the fields watching their flocks when Samuel came looking for the next anointed one. He is feeling every inch of having been raised the peasant, now being pursued by the king. Verses 11 to 16 introduce the lament proper, where verse 7 was kind of the intro. Verses 11 to 16 give us the substance. Malicious witnesses rise up. They ask me of things that I do not know. When they were sick, verse 13, I wore sackcloth. I afflicted myself with fasting. I prayed with head bowed down on my chest. But at my stumbling, verse 15, they rejoiced and gathered. They gathered together against me. So the evident ingratitude of those whom he went to when they were in trouble and said, let me help you. How can I help you? What can I bring you? How can I pray for you? When he's down, when he's out, they aren't looking for him. They turn around and pursue him. It's interesting that the whole section is characterized by the opening word verse 11, malicious. We encounter that word elsewhere in the Old Testament. One of the places is with Noah. It's violence that God found on all the earth when he decided to judge the world with the flood. That same word appears again in Malachi 2, where God says, I hate divorce. That verse, unfortunately, has been used in a very legalistic way in the history of the church against divorce. And it's unfortunate, not that God doesn't hate divorce, but what is overlooked, what is missed, is why God makes the statement. That's Malachi's point. I hate divorce because, and he's speaking specifically to husbands, you treat your wife like the dirt under your foot. And then because you are so hard-hearted, you say, I will divorce her. And what you're doing is you're using the law to cover the violence that is in your heart. That's what God hates. The sadness of divorce affects us. We know that. We can't get away from that. That is not the unforgivable sin. That's not what God is saying. God is saying what gives rise to the condition. And when you try to cover it up and justify it, that's what I hate. That's what they were doing to David. That same disposition. The same disposition he found throughout the land when Noah was there. This is what God does not like. David knows it. He's crying out to God, do you not see this? Verses 17 and 18 mirror verse 9 and 10. How long, O Lord, will you look on? Rescue me from their destruction, my precious life from the lions. The plea for deliverance again. And the seemingly conditional thanksgiving, I will thank you in the great congregation, in the mighty throng, I will praise you. Verses 19 to 21, pick up the second verse, if you will, of the lament. Let not those rejoice over me who are wrongfully my foes. Let not those who wink the eye who hate me without cause. For they do not speak peace. Against those who are quiet in the land, they devise words of deceit. We begin to get a picture of how David perceives those who are in pursuit of him. Interestingly, the phrase in verse 7, without cause, mentioned twice, is also mentioned again in verse 19. Three times in this psalm, David says, without cause, they have pursued me. We'll come back to that in a few minutes. That is really important. Verses 22 to 26 represent the concluding plea, you have seen, O Lord. I love how the contrast is established between verse 21 and 22. They open wide their mouths against me. They say, aha, aha, our eyes have seen it. To which David says, you have seen, O Lord. Be not silent. They think they see, but you really see. Act on what you see. And again, verse 26, reiterating this theme of vengeance, let them be put to shame and disappointed altogether. Let them be clothed with shame and dishonor who magnify themselves against me. Finally, in verses 27 to 28, we get to an abbreviated assurance and an abbreviated section of praise. Let those who delight in my righteousness shout for joy and be glad and say evermore, great is the Lord who delights in the welfare of his servant. Then my tongue shall tell of your righteousness and of your praise all the day long. Finally, at the end of the psalm, David's focus shifts from his own righteousness to the righteousness of God. Something that had been the clear focus in Psalm 34. Now, only at the very end of Psalm 35 does it appear. How can that be? How can it be that we go from the exaltation of Psalm 34 to the life in the pit in Psalm 35? Well, let me ask you, when you have faced challenges in your lives, have you ever experienced confidence in the Lord one day, followed by, where are you the next? Is this really so strange? In fact, I think that one of the ways we answer our second question, what is the mighty act of God, is in noticing how these two psalms do fit together as companion pieces. God perfectly gives voice to what we are experiencing, both when we are confident, and David can say, I'm looking to you, Lord, and I am trusting you. But in the same moment, he gives voice to those places where we are near despair and we don't know what to say or how to say it. God, in effect, says, here, try these words. These will work. You have a complaint against me? Here, talk to me. I'll show you. I'll lead you. What's also interesting, though, as we look at what the mighty act is, because really, in Psalm 35, there is no mighty act that he can talk about. He's looking for it. He wants it in the form of vengeance. He wants those who have given him the kick in the teeth to get their own. But is that what God has in mind for a mighty act? It is a mighty act that we can say, look at what God does when he gives us words to say when we don't have the words to say. That is something that we and the generations that follow need to be shown. We need to tell others of how good God is and even enabling us to give voice to our hearts. But therein lies the problem with the psalm. It's our hearts. They're hard. I wonder if the David of Psalm 51, after he had committed adultery with Bathsheba and then sent her husband, innocent, into battle to have him killed, and who knows how many others died in that engagement just to cover his sin. I wonder if that David would read this psalm the same way he did when he wrote it. Would he say, without cause, then? I don't think so. And that puts David on the horns of a dilemma. It puts us back on the horns of the dilemma that we have as Christians, saying, how do we deal with this cry for vengeance? That leads to the third question, which actually answers the second question. What is the mighty act? It's where we find Christ in the psalm. The only one who can say, they have unjustly treated me without cause to this pain and suffering, is Jesus. He's the one who can read this psalm and speak it with complete integrity. He's the one who has the right to a call for vengeance. But when he is on the cross, what does he say? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. There will be a day when vengeance will be his. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. I will repay. Paul quotes that to the effect of saying to you and me, don't you seek vengeance. That belongs to God. You instead, by acts of love and grace, are going to put burning coals in the heads of your enemies. It's a bit of irony. If I want my enemy to suffer, I need to love him. That's going to change my heart. As I do. And isn't that the point? One of the other interesting aspects of this psalm is that it is in giving voice to what's in our heart that it is exposed to our consciousness and our consciences that we then bring it to God and say, oh, wow, this is ugly. Where do I go with this, Lord? And it's especially difficult when we have been treated unjustly. Anybody in the room ever been treated unjustly? God is giving David the freedom to acknowledge that. I don't like it when people say, you shouldn't talk to God like that. You shouldn't complain to him. Oh, yes, I should. He's given me almost a third, nearly a half of the psalm to do it. But it doesn't stop there. I don't have these words so I can wallow in my self-pity. He's given me these words so I can come to Jesus, so that I can read this psalm in his mouth, so that I can hear him say without cause and say, that's right, because I was among those pursuing you. And I did it without cause, because you didn't deserve it. Who are you that you would forgive me? Who are you that you would cry to God from the cross for my salvation? That's the mighty act that we need to tell the next generation and all the generations around us. God will judge. Make no mistake. His justice will be satisfied, and it's going to be satisfied in one of two ways. Either as we look to Christ as the one who sufficiently pays that price, or as we look to ourselves, hoping that our good deeds will count more than our bad. I don't want to be weighed on that scale. I know I'm already dead by that measure. I need the salvation that Jesus provides. I need the hope of the good news, the justified by grace through faith in him alone. I am free. That's where Psalm 35 should lead us. It should take us and move us beyond looking at ourselves. We need to end where it does, shifting the focus from our lament, real though it may be, but to bring that lament before the righteousness of God in the righteousness of Christ. That's our hope. That's good news. Think about that. Let's sing.